Welcome to The Point. I'm Mindy Todd. On today's program, we explore Antarctica with naturalist Elizabeth Bradfield and discuss the history of seafaring music. We begin with Elizabeth Bradfield, a writer and naturalist. Her new book is Toward Antarctica, An Exploration. Welcome. Good to see you.
Thanks for having me.
And you actually have, you write a lot of poetry, and you had a book previously called Approaching Ice, which was also focused on Antarctica. So you've had this sort of passion for Antarctica. Tell us where that comes from.
It kind of came in through the back door, actually. Right out of college, I took a job working as a deckhand on a boat, and we went up to Alaska. It was an ecotourism boat, which at the time didn't really matter to me. I was just like, boat, Alaska, great. And when I left the boat, when my contract was up, I was landbound. I had a desk job, and I was really missing that life. I had lived for a year on board. I loved it so much. I left for messy reasons. But I was missing that life so much. And I went into a bookstore. I was living in Port Townsend, Washington at the time, and, you know, browsing around the used books. And they had this really dramatic book with a cover of a ship going down in the ice. And I was like, ooh, boats. Yes, I miss them. I will read this book. And it turned out to be Alfred Lansing's book, Endurance, about Sir Ernest Shackleton. And I was totally hooked from then on.
So you wrote Approaching Ice, not having visited Antarctica.
That's right.
So then you go there the first time. And was it what you expected?
It was and it wasn't. There's so much imagery about Antarctica available. I'm always curious when I go to a new place, especially a place that I've researched and studied, what's going to catch me out of the corner of my eye? What's going to be the thing that the books don't really talk about? I was surprised by the mosses, how lush the mosses are. I was surprised by the smells. And what really captured my attention was what it was like to work there, what it was like to work as a naturalist in this place, which was not really discussed in all of my exploration narratives that I'd read.
Yeah. So talk about that. It's really a very fragile landscape. You wouldn't think so, but it is, the mosses especially.
Yeah, it is fragile. A lot of the landings that you make on the continent itself are onto cobble or onto snow, even glaciers sometimes. And those landscapes are fragile in response to temperature and climate, but they're not fragile really in response to people's feet. Mm-hmm. But the little bit of vegetation that can exist on the continent, which mostly is mosses, they're very fragile. So when you make a landing in Antarctica, there are very strict guidelines for where you can put your boots and where you can't.
Yeah. And how many people can land at one time, right?
Exactly, yeah.
What's the max?
100. 100 people at most landing sites. Mm-hmm. There are a few exceptions at some of the research bases.
Yeah. And I think you were mentioning a talk we did a while ago about the big cruise ships. They can't do landings because there's just too many people on them.
That's right.
So they
yeah.
can't even do 100 at a time because it would be just too much.
It would be all day
yeah.
getting those 2,000 people ashore.
Yeah. And you mentioned the smell. What's the smell? I mean,
like
I think here, you know, sometimes you hear low tide or you have the salt in the air. What is it? What's the smell?
The smell of a penguin rookery is sharp. It's really sharp. It's tangy. Yeah. I guess you get the same scent if you're leaving out of Provincetown Harbor and smell the cormorant colony out there.
Or the seals on Monomoy. I was birding on Monomoy a few years back, and I remember, as we kind of came up behind all this, it's like, whoa, I wasn't expecting it to be that strong.
Yeah, and the seals, they especially, their smell gets more intense as they get toward breeding. So in fall, I think their smell gets a lot sharper as well.
So you did a second trip to Antarctica. Mm-hmm. So talk about, you had this idea for the book after the first trip, right?
I had the idea for the book even before I went down in a way, but I wasn't sure. I was kind of keeping it quiet even to myself. I didn't want to freak myself out. So when I was getting ready to go down, I had been reading a lot of Basho, who's a Japanese poet from the 1600s, most famous for his haiku, but he invented this form, the haibun, that he used. He would make these long foot journeys, 2,500 kilometers on foot into the mountains in the 1600s. And to record those journeys, he would blend short kind of my own personal diary journal prose interspersed with moments where He felt more emotional resonance, and then he would break into haiku, into poetry. Mm-hmm. And I was curious to see if that form would also work for this journey.
Yeah. All right, so before we get into the haibun, how did you happen to land on that to begin with? I mean, 16th century, you know, I mean, were you just glancing through some library? Or, I mean, how did you even pick that book up?
Well, my first introduction to the form actually came through a really dear friend of mine, the poet Sean Hill. And in his first book of poems, he had a poem called Milledgeville Haibun. And I was like, hey, Sean, what is this
haibun?
Haibun, as I said it at the time. And he introduced me to the form, and then I became very curious about it.
I would say I was curious because I had never heard of it before I read your book, and I thought, oh, that's interesting. So it's really sort of combines prose and haiku, right?
Yes.
So tell us about how you structured this book. And it's also photographs. So we have footnotes.
There's a lot going
on. Yeah. So tell us a little bit about the reader's experience when they pick this book up.
Well, it's my hope that the book takes a reader on a journey beginning in Santiago Valparaiso and Valparaiso in Chile, down the coast of Patagonia to Ushuaia, over to South Georgia Island, down to the continent, to the Falklands, back to Ushuaia. So over the course of many trips to Antarctica, two contracts, but many trips. So when I go to work, I usually am on the boat for 1 to 2 months at a time, which means several trips for the guests who join us and leave. So I kind of blended the chronological narrative to have a more complete physical journey mm-hmm. between those places. And so each page has one moment of that journey. One place, usually they're grounded in a place and time. Sometimes on the facing page, there's a photograph, an image that interacts with the text, not mm-hmm. as direct illustration usually, mm-hmm. but as a kind of a third leg of the tripod.
Do you want to read something for us? Give our listeners an idea.
Sure.
Yeah, that'd be great.
I haven't thought about what exactly I might read. Mm-hmm. How about this one? Patagonia, Pio 11 Glacier. But now, at last, at tiller, this throttle's particulars, stiff arm, ragged idle, acquired. Finally of use in a way I want to be used and useful. Overtowered by ice rivering to tidewater. The usual dangers, less known here. Depth at face, advance, tongue. Gauge best as possible. Known cool of ice breath, known furl of wake. So used to retreat and loss beyond seasonal ablation, almost terrifying to see the hunger of advance. Familiar ice, unfamiliar surge, forested edge overcome. Steer to pace fact and awe, motion and drift, putter in sun. Kelp geese strut the intertidal. Usual metaphors for blue fumbled as ice pops and groans. Glad to fumble them anew.
Did you have fun writing with this style?
Oh, I had so much fun. Yeah, I had so much fun just trying to pull out every unnecessary article I could and compress that language and let the sound. You know when a wave comes in and all the rocks chitter over each other and make that great, great sound? Mm-hmm. I wanted that sense in the words.
And now the photos. You took some of the photos on your first trip.
Yeah.
And then the second trip you went and you thought, okay, I'm going to get photos of some things I need. Talk about the difference in those two trips and your thought process with the photos.
Yeah. So when I was thinking about the haibun, when I was thinking about writing, I wasn't thinking of pairing the writing with images. But when I got home and started thinking about these, I was interested in them resonating alongside each other. So I went through my photographs, most of which I took for documentation. And every once in a while, I'd find one that felt like it wasn't a classic representation of Antarctica, wasn't a hero narrative, me on the ice kind of narrative, which I wasn't interested in exploring in this book. And I would pull that out and think about how it resonated with the text. It had those images had an emotional resonance for me. And when I finished writing the first draft of this book and knew I was going to go down again, I thought, oh, great, this will be a chance for me to finally get an image that works with this or of this. And I didn't do so good.
Yeah. You were overthinking it, right?
I was totally overthinking it. Yeah. There are a few things that worked, but not many.
Yeah. Now, will you go back?
I'm not sure. I'm not scheduled for any trips down there now. Antarctic tourism is expanding by about 15% a year.
Yeah. Which is, who would think, I mean, when I saw that statistic on the ecotourism, what was it?
The IATO site.
Yeah. And it was it 2016-17 season, there were
51,000
tours, an increase of 15% for the previous season, which was above the previous season. Mm-hmm. This is a destination now for people. And as we mentioned, it's fragile.
It is fragile. And a lot of this is driven by the what's termed last chance tourism, the desire to see places before they disappear. And I understand that. I'm happy that people want to connect with the beautiful places of this world. I'm happy they have concerns. I empathize with that. I also worry about our impact on those voyages. And so I want to think really carefully about my next steps as a guide and how I can do that in a way that feels like it acknowledges the problematic nature of travel and finds a way to make that travel somehow a stepping stone toward conservation.
Yeah. Now, when you go back and look at your book, Approaching Ice, do you read that differently now that you've been there than when you put it together? Does it resonate any more with you now? Or
it resonates more personally. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of poems in that book about imagining the feel of that cold and that ice. I'm happy to let it be its own moment in time. Mm-hmm. Yeah. If I were to write that book now, I think I would have different questions that I'd want to answer, but I'm happy with what it was doing.
Yeah, talk a little about some of the wildlife there. You have lots of stuff. The penguin rookeries were fascinating to me. How we used to locate them, scientists used to look at, and how they locate them now was really fascinating. And that was a footnote, but they do it with satellite images now.
Yes, aren't the footnotes fun?
The footnotes are fun. I really like the footnotes. I think you mentioned something in a talk we did that you were like, you kind of like, oh, I don't know about the footnotes, but I thought the footnotes were very helpful.
I'm such a nerd. I love footnotes. I love indices. I love all of that book paraphernalia. But yeah, the most recent penguin colonies have been tracked by satellite images, not of the penguins themselves, but their poop.
Their poop, yep. Which is, as you said, part of the smell there. Some of the surprises you had, what encounters, I'm thinking of like the creatures or, you know, what you came across, like the seals,
The Weddell seals.
Weddell seals, thank you. That's something that you don't know until you experience it, right? The sound they make?
Yeah, you can hear recordings of Weddell seals, but I guess I didn't realize before witnessing it that they vocalize not only when they're in the water, but when they're on land. And when Weddell seals vocalize, air is not leaving their mouth, their nose. They're all sealed up and they're producing these sounds. And to see a young seal lounged out on the shore and making these odd noises.
It's not what you expect.
It's arresting. Yeah.
I was saying, and I didn't experience, obviously, in Antarctica, but as soon as I read that in the book, I Googled it to say, and these were seals who were on land. And I was like, wow, that is a weird sound that they make.
Yeah.
So was there any surprises to you when you had these trips to Antarctica?
Yeah, I got into a couple of prickly situations. In terms of just weather changing really radically and rapidly. And I've worked on boats for a long time, and I have a lot of respect for the sea, for weather. I've worked in the Arctic every season since 2008, so I'm familiar with high-latitude travel. But we got into one situation where the weather just turned on a dime, and I was honestly afraid for my life. Mm. And I was so mad at myself for putting myself, my family, in that kind of situation.
Yeah. Well, hindsight, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
So what inspires you?
So much.
Yeah. Life, right?
Yeah. Life inspires me. My work as a naturalist inspires me. I'm so curious to... I'm so eager to understand how people see the natural world, what lenses they look through. We all move through the world with these bodies, right? And these bodies carry family history, cultural history, our own personal obsessions, whether it's with knitting or asteroids or whatever. And that influences the metaphors we make to explain the world. And so as a writer, I'm really interested in trying to imagine into other people's lenses how they see the natural world and how that squares and doesn't square with what we know scientifically and factually.
Yeah. I say, because that's a really broad range. As we know, there are people who are very excited for any kind of wildlife in their yard and others who are like, ooh, get it out, you know?
Yeah.
That kind of coexisting thing. Sometimes we need to work a little on that, don't we?
We do. We do.
So what are you working on now?
I'm finishing up a collaboration with a Chicago-based artist. So it's another step, I guess, into this integrated world of text and image. The book is called Theorem, and it uses Antonia Contro's beautiful images. And I wrote a narrative in response to a collection of these images. And it explores the legacy of a childhood secret, kind of told through map-making, math-making.
Yeah. Now, what is that like for you working in a collaboration like that versus where you're working kind of with your own emotions and your own thoughts?
It's been really exciting. It's been exciting to have that spark of her images. As a publisher, I run a press called Broadsided Press, and we publish collaborations between writers and visual artists. So I've been enabling that kind of work for a long time, and it's really exciting to actually do it now.
All right, now I'm going to have you put on your naturalist hat for a moment and give some thought to what we're doing with the younger generation. It seems, you know, they're stuck in front of their video games and TV and they don't really explore, but that's kids. I mean, when they're young, that's their natural curiosity. They want to pick up rocks on the beach and things that we're like, why would you want to keep that? So what's your advice to people about how we educate young people on the natural world?
Get dirty. Get muddy, get messy. I think we need to find a way of balancing a concern for the impact that we have on the natural world. You know, don't separate the fox and her kits, but step back and look. We are not always a vector of harm. We're part of the natural world. And the more we can feel that connection, eating stuff from the ground, whether it's wild picked blueberries or dandelion leaves in your yard, oysters from the beach, getting wet, going out in the bad weather and realizing you're not going to melt.
Dance in the rain.
Elizabeth
Bradfield, her new book is Toward Antarctica, An Exploration. Thanks so much for making the trek in here to talk with us.
Thank you for having me, Mindy.
Coming up after a break, traditional and contemporary maritime music.